Someone told you knee pain is just getting older? They were wrong. The Joint Relief Institute offers fast joint pain relief covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
Last month, an Illinois jury returned a $241 million wrongful death verdict to the family of a man named Eric Johnson, who was a courier who died after being exposed to carbon dioxide while transporting some frozen goods. It's a really large verdict, and I want to discuss the case with the personal injury attorney, who is one of the country's premier catastrophic injury lawyers, Patrick Salvi II. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Karen. Thanks for having me.
Just by way of background, for over 40 years, this law firm, Salvi, Shostak & Pritchard, has been a nationally recognized firm in the area of personal injury, malpractice, with verdicts and settlements over $3.5 billion, and I say B with a billion with a B. And Patrick here has been the managing partner and has been responsible for recovering over $1.7 billion on behalf of his deserving clients. So let's talk a little bit about this case. Can you tell our listeners who Eric Johnson was and what happened to him?
Yeah, so very tragic case. Eric Johnson, he was 64 years old. And during the course of his life, his career was primarily in accounting and in finance. And after having a client that had a courier business, he and his wife decided that because of their home situation, which I'll come back to in a moment, that he would start his own courier business. And that's what he did. And the primary reason that he did that is him and his wife, Paula, they have five children. Three of them are their biological children. And then they have two children that they adopted, both of whom are really profoundly disabled. They have one child who has cerebral palsy, who's very functional, but has tremendous needs. And then another who was abused as an infant, physically abused, and suffered a horrible brain injury, and is very challenging to take care of just in terms of her impulsivity and her delayed cognition. And so because of that, their home life really required for both of them to be at home as much as possible. So he started this courier business out of his home. He primarily would take auto parts and documents, title documents for real estate closings, things of that nature, relatively short distances. But on this occasion, he was hired by a Prairie Farms dairy subsidiary, PFD Supply, to take frozen strawberries that were mistakenly left off of a truck. They were supposed to go down from St. Peter's, Missouri, down to Arkansas. And so he goes to pick these frozen strawberries up that they mistakenly left off the truck to run about 100 pounds or so of strawberries down to Arkansas. In order to do that, you have to pack these frozen strawberries with dry ice. Unbeknownst to Eric, dry ice sublimates. Not something that everybody knows. Some folks understand this, but it's not well understood, as I've come to learn. Dry ice sublimates into carbon dioxide. It doesn't melt like normal, you know, wet ice. It sublimates directly into carbon dioxide, and has an over 500-to-1 expansion rate. In other words, if you take a little pellet of dry ice, multiply that by 500, and that's how much carbon dioxide is going to be in the atmosphere. And so he wasn't provided any warnings. The coolers didn't have any warnings. Nobody told him how to do it. He showed up in a little Honda Fit, which is, anybody that knows what a Honda Fit is, it's very small. Not a huge cab where the driver sits. It was hot out. It was in August. It was raining. Didn't really make a lot of sense for him to roll the windows down for any reason, nor was he told to. And so about 10 or so minutes into the drive, best we can tell from the evidence, he's becoming lightheaded. It has a disorienting effect on the human body as you're breathing in carbon dioxide. It has no odor. You can't see it. And so he had no idea. And so as he's pulling off the side of the road, he's becoming disoriented. He ultimately gets into a parking lot. He parks awkwardly, evident that he was essentially, it's like you're intoxicated. If you look at the literature on carbon dioxide, you breathe it in and it has this intoxicating effect where you're impaired. And so he kind of parks crooked and then passes out. And it's about an hour and a half later that he's found, but sadly it was too late and he died.
So this tragedy seems very preventable. Well, the verdict seems to say that the jury, you know, the jury felt that same way too. Was there some reason why the dairy company didn't say to this guy, who, why would he know about these things? Frankly, I think I know a lot about a lot of things. I did not know anything you just told me about dry ice. Why would I know that? Why didn't they tell him?
Right, and what we really uncovered during discovery, and what we made quite clear to the jury at trial, is that the training processes that existed were deficient. So, the general manager at the facility really had a lack of awareness as to the dangers of dry ice. The safety manager, who was also the warehouse manager, he was responsible for training folks on any of the hazardous chemicals that they had at the facility, and they didn't really train about dry ice and the potential hazards, even though they had what's called an MSDS or an SDS sheet in their binder that had all of the hazards to warn people about the risk of rapid suffocation and impairment and loss of consciousness, and to ensure that when it's transported that there be adequate ventilation. So they didn't do any of that, in large part because of a lack of training in the years leading up to this. And really one of the reasons that I think it ultimately led to a punitive award, where the jury said, hey, we need to enter a verdict that's going to deter not just this company but others from engaging in this type of behavior going forward, is because they had been cited by OSHA a number of times at other facilities for not having hazard communication program, which is required by OSHA. And so really with that, you saw that there wasn't a very good understanding even within the facility about the hazards of dry ice, and so they didn't pass it on. They didn't put labels on the cooler, which really should have been the MO whenever you're transporting hazardous chemicals.
Well, and, you know, that's surprising. They have somebody there who's supposed to be doing this safety stuff, and it fell down, and the person who is supposed to, you know, be charged with all this really had nothing to do with it. And, you know, the OSHA violations, I would imagine, could really upset a jury, that you've been told once, you've been told twice, how many times, that you're creating a hazard, and yet this man had to pay with it for his life. Can we talk just briefly? There's an element of this case called bad faith, and can you educate our listeners as to what that means in the law and what you're going to be seeking in this case relating to that?
Absolutely. So frequently when folks see that there are large verdicts, what's not well reported, what's not well understood, is that the plaintiffs that are the recipients of these verdicts often tried to settle the case beforehand. That certainly goes for this case. Our client would have resolved the case for less than $10 million, and that was made clear to the insurance company, Travelers, an insurance company many people have heard of. And so what happens is, if the insurance company, if there's a reasonable probability that the verdict is going to be against the defendant and in excess of the policy limits of the insurance company, and there's a demand made within the policy, in other words, a plaintiff is willing to settle within the policy, that triggers what's called a duty to settle if all those elements are met. And we certainly think they were met here because of the likelihood of success and the likelihood that the verdict would have exceeded Travelers' policy. But Travelers refused to negotiate in good faith. And as a result, Prairie Farms, their assets were tremendously exposed by this verdict, and especially the fact that there was a punitive aspect to it. And really, at the end of the day, Prairie Farms wanted Travelers to settle the case for the protection of themselves, and because I think they recognized that they were in the wrong and they wanted the case to be resolved. Travelers refused to do that, and because of that, Travelers can be responsible for the entire verdict, not just the limits of their policy. And on top of that, because of the reputational harm and business harm that it does to the defendant, they can be responsible not only for the judgment, but for their own punitive damages for acting willfully, recklessly.
And, you know, I think that it's that some of these verdicts and some of these settlements that you see, really, you know, we have to look at what would stop a company from doing unsafe things. What would stop an insurance company from not negotiating in good faith and exposing the insured, the person who's paying you these high premiums over the years, and so something tragic happens, and instead of paying what they should and negotiating in good faith, they basically say, we're not doing it. You know, I think it sends a message, and I think maybe these insurance companies and companies are going to think twice about their safety issues, about not negotiating in good faith, and it just changes the way corporate America works. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, they're really, when you think about it, they're really rolling the dice. Think about it this way. Let's say the exposure to the defendant is $20 million and the insurance company has a $1 million policy. Plaintiff says, hey, look, this case is worth a lot more than a million, but we'll accept the $1 million policy for settlement. And the insurance company says, hey, we're probably going to lose, but if we lose, we're only out a million. And if we settle for a million, we're out a million. Why not just roll the dice? Well, the reason they can't do that is because if they do it that way, they're not holding their insured's interests equal to their own. They're rolling the dice and they're exposing their insured to greater liability. That's why bad faith laws are really important. Illinois has good laws, and really across the country, most states have good laws on bad faith so that insurance companies can't do that.
Right. You want them to be on your side. That's why you're paying the premiums. And I don't care if you're a huge company or a little guy with a small car insurance policy. You want them to be acting on your behalf. Quickly, I want to talk about another verdict that I see. It was a $363 million jury verdict for a woman who developed breast cancer from breathing in toxic emissions from the Willowbrook Medical Device Sterilization Plant. We read a lot about those problems in the news for years, and it was the largest verdict ever awarded to an individual plaintiff in Illinois history at the time of trial. It's a huge verdict. Can you just briefly tell us what we know about what happened there in Willowbrook and what was going on with the emanations from this plant?
Yeah, sure. So in Willowbrook, there was a company, Sterigenics. They use ethylene oxide to sterilize medical equipment. Sterilizing medical equipment is a good thing. It prevents infections. It keeps our medical equipment clean. However, when folks do that with ethylene oxide, which is a known carcinogen, what you have to do is you have to have pollution controls. And for many years in the 80s and throughout the 90s and even really through the 2000s, they were emitting not just thousands of pounds, but tens and in some years hundreds of thousands of pounds of ethylene oxide into the community. My client lived about a third of a mile away. Through air modeling, we were able to show how much ethylene oxide she was breathing in over the course of the 20 years that she lived there before she was diagnosed with breast cancer, which is a type of cancer that is known to be linked to ethylene oxide exposure through the epidemiological studies. And so in that case, we had our firm had about 250 clients, and there were about 900 plaintiffs total. But that trial was about one plaintiff, so it was $38 million in compensatory for her damages relative to her breast cancer and the treatment and all the effects it had on her. And then there was $325 million in punitive damages, which was tethered to the size of these companies. It represented about 10% of their net worth. And that's what the jury said in terms of what was appropriate. You can't just give them a slap on the wrist. It's got to be an amount that sends a message that hurts. Not put them out of business, but hurts. And so that's what they did. And that was a successful trial that ultimately led to a settlement that I think was very beneficial for that Western suburban community and sent a message really across the industry of ethylene oxide that if you're going to use that chemical to do whatever it is you're doing, sterilizing typically metal equipment or other things, you got to do so in a way where you're not exposing people to it unnecessarily.
Absolutely. And that sends a message loud and clear. I'm going to give out our numbers for the next 35 minutes or so. We're going to be talking to Patrick about personal injury and medical malpractice. And I know I get a lot of listeners who call in about possible malpractice cases. And I want Patrick to explain a little bit about why these cases are so difficult and maybe give some practical advice, too, on how to avoid having malpractice occur. So let's, before we take a break here, we got a few minutes. These are difficult cases. Can you tell our listeners why they're a little bit different than your standard car accident case or other types of cases?
Yeah, there are a few reasons, I would say. First of all, because of the necessary expert work that is required. In fact, in Illinois, you have to have an expert certify your case as meritorious before you can even file it, which I think is a fine rule in terms of maintaining integrity in the cases that are filed. But it does add a costly element to it. And frequently we need experts not only in the field of the doctor or nurse or whatever the healthcare provider is. You have to have someone in that field who is critical of them before you can even file a case. But then in order to prove causation, that the negligence actually had an impact on the outcome, you frequently have to have additional experts. And so it can become very costly. That's one of the barriers to entry, I would say, is just how costly these cases are. Also, just from the standpoint of jury appeal, when you go in front of a jury, clearly the defendant in a malpractice case is a doctor, a nurse, or some other type of healthcare provider, a physician's assistant. And by and large, these are folks that are acting in good faith, who are working hard, who are putting in hours, who train for years and years and years to be in the position that they're in. They hold high prestige in the community, and those are the defendants. And so in order to prove a case against them, as I'll tell any potential client, it can't just be some little one-off mistake. It really has to be something that is negligent, that clearly violated the standard of care. And in light of the cost, frequently in order to bring a malpractice case, for it to even be worth anyone's while, the injury really does have to be catastrophic. It needs to be something very, very serious to make it ultimately worthwhile. And so, you know, those confluence of factors, in addition, really on the other side, when you think about it, you have hospitals, particularly in Chicago, you have very prestigious hospitals. When you talk about Northwestern, University of Chicago, Rush, and you're talking about folks that have access to the best experts across the country to defend their conduct, the most well-credentialed experts. So that's what we face when we file a medical malpractice case, and that's why we have to screen them so well to make sure that they are very strong cases, that we can prove them, and use the medical records, which are written by the defendants, and they know what they're writing. You know, they are writing the operative report, they're writing the progress notes, and that's typically the evidence in the case. And so in order to prove those cases, it's very challenging, but if it's a strong case and malpractice occurred, then, you know, we feel like we're up to that challenge.
And I think one of the things, we only have a minute left here before we have to go to a break, that, you know, a lot of things in medicine, the same with the law, you can't guarantee results. There are a lot of factors, a lot of things that can happen in a case. So if, you know, you give a medicine and there might be five different things that could happen, and you might be that 1% of the patients who react poorly to it, or there might be a complication of infection that is a known complication, but you got the surgery anyway. And in those cases, that wouldn't be malpractice. And I think a lot of people, it's hard for them to understand that getting an infection might be a known risk.
No, that's true. Defenses frequently talk about clinical judgment, that if a doctor is simply exercising clinical judgment, just because the decision's ultimately wrong, you can't say it was negligent. That's hindsight bias. And so those types of cases are not strong cases and not the types of cases that we take.
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing, their family has your family covered.
Let's talk about some proactive things, because I know that a lot of my listeners are either dealing with medical issues or advocating for a loved one who are, you know, who may be getting treatments. And I hear this all the time, and it's very important to be a good advocate. Tell our listeners what you see happens in malpractice cases and how people can prevent something like that from happening to them or their loved ones.
Yeah, I think you used the key word when you said advocating. So whether you're advocating for yourself or for somebody else, what does advocating mean? Let's say it's an outside the hospital situation where you're seeing your primary doctor or specialists. You know, do the best you can for yourself in terms of following up and making sure that whether it's lab values or vital signs or pain, listen to your body and respond to it and be proactive in terms of going to your doctor, demanding that you get answers. I mean, you can have a very good relationship with your doctor without, you know, necessarily being pushy, but while still asking direct questions and getting answers. And then certainly if you're at the hospital or if you're in the middle of some sort of an acute situation, you want to follow up on all the diagnostics. So a lot of times the critical results have to do with those lab values or have to do with radiology. What's going on inside the brain? What's going on inside your heart or inside your abdomen that led you to the hospital, whatever the case may be? And don't let too much time go by without speaking up and saying something. What's going on? What's next? Okay, let's say the CT CT scan says there's a brain bleed after dad hit his head from a fall. What do we do next? Is it going to be an operation? Have an understanding. So that type of communication and advocacy is going to make it a lot less likely that malpractice occurs to you. Because a lot of times it's those delays.
Yes.
It's the delay in addressing either something on a diagnostic exam or new symptoms, things of that nature.
Well, and professionals are busy. And, you know, it's, I always say squeaky wheel, right? You know, sometimes without being a jerk, without being pushy or nasty, you can insist that you get immediate attention. And sometimes the person who's sick or, you know, has the issue doesn't feel like doing that or doesn't want to do that. So as an advocate, I know I've done that for loved ones where I make the call. I make the difficult call to say, we really need to get this done immediately. And I think that's very important. And I know this is a big question with a lot of different moving parts, but when you do see malpractice, whether it's like you say, a doctor, a nurse, a physician's assistant, what are some of the typical reasons that there is malpractice? Is it the nature and quality of the physician? Is it inattentiveness, not explaining things to a patient? What do you see as some of the problems in malpractice cases?
I think a lot of times it's a systems failure. And so one hand either doesn't know what the other is doing or is making assumptions. You know, I think of a young boy who had what's called a syrinx in his spinal cord, which is just a collection of fluid. And over the course of years, that syrinx was growing, and it grew significantly over, say, 3 to 5 years. And he was getting scans every 6 months. And every time he got a scan, it grew a little bit. And then it grew a little bit. And between the neurosurgeon, the neurologist, and the neuroradiologists, they weren't really going back and assessing 2, 3, 4 years back. They were just looking at the last scan and comparing it to the new scan. And they would say, well, it's about the same when it grew maybe a millimeter. Well, 1 millimeter over 10 scans is, that's a centimeter, and that's too big within the small area of the spinal cord. So that's an example where there was a systems failure between multiple providers who just weren't doing that deep dive that they had to do to recognize that this syrinx within the spinal cord was now becoming very problematic for the patient and causing symptoms. So a lot of times it is some sort of a symptom that goes overlooked, that is not taken seriously enough, and that brings us back to that advocacy piece, where if somebody goes into the hospital with abdominal pain and all of a sudden their legs are becoming weak, you have to think, well, what the heck is going on here? Let's try to make a connection. Maybe there's a ruptured aneurysm, and now there's not enough blood flow to the spinal cord, leading to weakness in the legs. That needs to be addressed immediately with some sort of a scan like an MRI. But if you just let that weakness go on for hours and hours and hours, it could become permanent. So again, advocacy, speaking up, and that way you're more likely to avoid malpractice.
And, you know, as you are talking about this, you sound like a doctor. And one of the things that I'm quite sure is that when you practice in this area and you do this kind of work, whether it's medical malpractice or personal injury that has resulting injuries, you have to explain these really complicated medical issues, whether it's because of the causation and you need to prove, or whether you want to explain to a jury why this is going to be problematic for the rest of the plaintiff's life. You have a pretty good working knowledge of medicine,
yeah,
right?
You have to. Yeah.
You have to. And you have to make it understandable, do you not?
Because absolutely.
Do you think jurors get it? Do you think jurors understand these complicated explanations and medical issues?
Yeah, well, we have the burden of proof on the plaintiff's side. So if a jury does not understand the issues, and if they don't understand what our theory of the case is, we're going to lose. And so what we have to do is we have to do a number of things. So I implement kind of a high-tech, low-tech combination when I try a case. The high-tech is you have animations made that show the different areas of the anatomy. Maybe you're showing a surgery. Maybe you're showing how, for example, a young man who has a problem with his blood clotting, how that ultimately leads to him having a clot in his foot, which then cuts off the blood supply to the rest of the foot, and he ultimately needs it to be amputated because there was a delay in the diagnosis of the clotting problem. And so what you have to do is not only make sure that the jury understands the anatomy and the and your theory of the case in terms of what you think should have done, but also had the doctor not acted negligent, had the doctor done what he or she should have done, how that would have changed the outcome. And so you do that with visuals. But then also, you heard me just a few minutes ago talk about a syrinx. Well, syrinx is a fancy word, but what that is fluid in the spinal cord. And I think people can understand the spinal cord. That's like our central computer system for the human body. And so if you start to have an impairment within the spinal cord, people understand that, look, if you have an injury to the spinal cord, you could become paralyzed. And so if there's fluid in the spinal cord, that can slowly cause weakness, and that needs to be reversed immediately. Otherwise, you risk it becoming permanent and becoming worse. And so taking those concepts and showing people visually and then making sure that you can explain it in an understandable way, it's really essential. I don't think a plaintiff can win at trial without doing it.
Absolutely. And like you said, I mean, I think we as lawyers in whatever case, whether it's a case of a business matter or whatever it is, we have to break it down so that people can relate to it, understand it, and really, you know, be able to use their common sense. Because jurors, if nothing else, they come to the jury room with their own personal experience and common sense. And I don't know about you, Patrick, but after 40 years of practice, I trust jurors.
I do too. I think jurors, by and large, get it right.
Yes.
I know in the news, folks, sometimes they see, for example, our recent verdict, which, if we had all the time in the world, I could explain to everybody exactly why it was a just and fair verdict, but it was $241 million, which is eye-catching. And you might say, well, geez, how could a verdict be that high? Well, hear the evidence, and I think you'll understand why. But what you don't see frequently in the news are all the times where it's either not guilty, or it's a much smaller verdict that's representative of a much lesser injury, or conduct that is negligent but did not rise to the level of culpability where there are punitive damages. And so, by and large, in malpractice, the statistics are pretty much defendants win. 3 out of 4, 4 out of 5.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, when they go to trial. I mean, and that's in part because they settle a lot of the good cases, so that's one of the reasons. And then even in a vehicular case, you know, a motor vehicle crash, even those are typically about 50-50 when you look at the statistics at trial. Again, the cases that are going to trial are the ones that are the most hotly disputed. And so that's not nearly as well reported on. So I think it's good for your listeners to hear that statistically speaking, the ones they see that are real big verdicts in the newspapers are tend to be outliers. That doesn't mean they're not just verdicts, but they tend to be outliers in terms of the amount.
Exactly. Yeah. Same with criminal cases. When you see someone walk free and you think they shouldn't have, you know, for every one of those, there's, you know, 100 that.
Yeah, prosecutors do pretty well.
They do pretty well, especially in the federal realm. A texter who basically said, what about suing paramedics for malpractice? I think in this case, maybe it took a long time for an ambulance to get there, and maybe there was a delay in giving help to this person. What do you think about that, Patrick?
Yeah, so the law recognizes that paramedics and those types of emergency personnel outside a hospital setting are in a unique position. And so what the law, particularly in Illinois and in many other places, provides for is immunity. They have immunity from negligence. Now, they don't have immunity from willful and wanton misconduct. So that's if we can show that there's been a conscious disregard for safety, some sort of recklessness. But short of being able to prove that, paramedics who are responding to an emergency situation do have immunity from negligence. So when we're reviewing a case like that, there really needs to be a heightened level of culpability. Like, for example, we have a case right now where they were supposed to take a child who was in distress, who had a heart condition, directly to Lurie's, and they simply missed the exit and went all the way up to Illinois Masonic, and ultimately that lost time cost this little girl her life. And without diving too deep into the facts, it was really egregious, the fact that this particular driver did not have proper training, did not understand where Lurie's Children's was, missed the exit, and that's the type of case that might be a case. But frequently, if you can only prove negligence, you really don't have a case against the paramedic. So it's a very fact intensive inquiry.
Yeah. And we were talking a little bit off air about telehealth and how, since COVID, of course, we have a lot of telehealth appointments. And I imagine it kind of cuts both ways. Well, how has telehealth helped giving good medical care, and how does it work against it?
Sure. And I've handled some cases where telehealth was involved. And I think what we've seen that, you know, on the one hand, telehealth makes physicians more accessible. You can have a visit sooner. Now, that being said, telehealth, you don't have a physical examination, and particularly in an acute setting, if someone's acutely requiring care via telehealth, it's hard to, you can't do a physical exam. You're relying on the physical exam of the people that are with the patient. It's harder to communicate directly with other healthcare providers responsible for the patient. There might be medical records or electronically, there might be some issues relative to what's available to the doctor that is not on scene. And so I've seen instances where things get lost in translation, and as a result, things are delayed. So I think telehealth, there are these positives and negatives, and one of the things that really frightens me, and what we've seen in our cases, is that the advent of private equity into health systems, where it becomes a business, where the bean counters are making decisions as to how many nurses need to be on the floor and how many patients doctors need to see. That's problematic for our healthcare system, and we're seeing that. And healthcare can't just be profit driven. I mean, they need to make a profit, and that all makes sense. And they are. However, it can't be so badly at the expense of care. And I think telehealth, if it's going to be done, particularly in acute care settings, there need to be significant safeguards in place so that what we know might be problematic about a telehealth doctor seeing a patient, that we can guard against those potential problems and ensure that doctor who's remote is getting the information he or she needs.
Absolutely. You know, I do get a lot of questions from listeners who say, gosh, it was 5 years ago, I was in this car accident, I didn't think I need a lawyer, but boy, my neck has never been the same, and now I'm going to require a couple surgeries to get it done. Can I bring a lawsuit? Right?
No.
Yeah. So tell our listeners about, if you are in a car accident, or if you have an accident or trip and fall, whatever it is, or you think you might have had some medical care that fell below, you know, what should have happened, and you have some problems, how quickly should you act and why?
Yeah, well, the bottom line answer is the sooner the better, and there's a few reasons for that. You mentioned 5 years, for example. The statute of limitations is 2 years from the date that you knew or should have known that you had a case, essentially. And so if you're in an automobile collision and you're injured, there's law that says, like, hey, you were involved in this kind of big deal on this particular day. That's the day. You have 2 years from that day. So there's two reasons you want to talk to a lawyer right away. Number one is to protect your rights. You don't want those 2 years to go by without knowing who the defendants are. Let's say, for example, you were hit by somebody and you didn't realize that they were working for Amazon, and you file right at the end of the 2 year limitations period, and you only file the case against the individual driver, and then it's not until you get into discovery that you learn that they were driving for Amazon, but you can't sue Amazon now because the time is run.
And you also need to make sure there are witnesses. You know, if there are witnesses,
that's,
or
the other one.
You know, people forget, people drop off the face of the earth. And again, even if you're not litigious, people don't want to be litigious. They really don't. I mean, you know this,
yeah.
But you never know what's going to happen. And once that toothpaste is out of the tube, you can't put it back in. And whether it's for you or your loved ones, you know, you need to take action. And,
yeah.
And for people like you, you listen to their case before you take, you don't take any money. You give them a listen, and you give them your assessment. So there's nothing really to lose.
There's nothing to lose. That's exactly right. We don't charge our clients on an hourly basis. We only get paid attorney's fees if we accept the case and then we win the case. And in fact, let's say we take a case and it's an expensive case and we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars of our own money hiring experts and working the case up for trial, and then we lose the trial, which is an aside, I will just say, is a very rare occurrence. I just want to point that out. But at the same time, if that were to happen, that's a business loss for us. And it's really important what you said, Karen, because number one, you're right. Gathering evidence is another critical piece to contacting a lawyer early. You don't want evidence to go cold. Frequently, video cameras, whether it's at a hospital or whether it's at an intersection, usually they're only saved for like a week or 30 days, and we need to get in immediately to get preservation letters out there, to get our investigators on the street to make sure we gather that stuff to prove our case. So that's critically important. The other thing is people frequently delay calling lawyers either because they don't want to feel as though they are being litigious or they're not sure they have a case. But you're absolutely right that they shouldn't hesitate. If you were to call me, for example, and let's say you didn't have a case, I'm going to talk you through it. I'm going to explain that to you. But then if you do have a case, I'm going to talk you through that as well, and you can make the informed decision. Because at the end of the day, I serve you. You're my client. Your interests are what become my interests 100%, period, end stop. And so I don't want anybody to think that it's a scary process. And believe me when I say that every single one of my clients, not one of them, says, oh, I'm glad I have a lawsuit. I'm glad I don't have mom anymore. I'm glad I have a lawsuit to get money. I'm glad I don't have use of my legs. I'm glad I have this excruciating pain in my knee or in my arm or in my neck for the rest of my life, but at least I can get money. Quite the contrary. What this is a balancing of the harm, and it is something that is enshrined in our Bill of Rights, the Seventh Amendment of the Constitution. It's really an aspect of our democracy where folks from the community get to listen to a case and say, what is the proper conduct under these circumstances? That's the first thing they do. And if the defendant is at fault, they say, what is this worth? In terms of the fair market value of what this plaintiff has gone through, now that I've heard it all from their doctors, from experts, from family members, and I've heard the defense too, and what they're going to say and how they oppose what the plaintiffs are saying, and I've heard it all, and now I'm going to make a decision as to what is the fair market value of this individual's pain and suffering, their future medical bills, and the other elements of damages. And it's really something that the community gets to step in and offer their opinion on through the jury system.
And I will say too, if you decide not to sue, and you said this, you don't have to sue, but just knowing that you have a suit or knowing you don't have a suit is very comforting, because you don't want to walk away from something and not know the answer to that question. And when it's too late, it's too late. We have 1 minute, but there's a great question coming out of the 608 area code. Could you ask your guests whether or not doctors' attitude, their arrogance or rudeness has anything to do with the likelihood of a family or patient bringing a malpractice suit? That's a good question.
That's a very good question. And if I were to speak to the healthcare providers out there, I would say that good bedside manner is going to make it much less likely that you're going to be sued. I do have to turn down cases frequently where there may have been negligence, but the injury is either didn't happen or is extremely minor. But the bedside manner was so bad, and there was that arrogance that the person calls. Now, on the other hand, I will say that successful medical malpractice lawsuits also can occur, because not only did negligence occur, but the doctor in his or her deposition or trial acts that way in front of the jury, and they don't like that, and they can see through that. And so, yes, that is definitely a factor in cases.
Patrick Salvi, thank you so much for joining us. Patrick Salvi the second is with the great law firm of Salvi, Shostak, and Pritchard. Quickly, how can people get in touch with you?
312-372-1227. That's our office number. And my email is psalvi2@salvilaw.com. P as in Patrick, S-A-L-V as in Victor, I, the number 2, @salvilaw.com.